You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, I would say that 87.5% of the time, I don't bother you on schedule.
Yeah.
Would you say that's about accurate? And then every once in a while, I'll say, you know what? There's someone I want to talk to that we haven't talked to in a while. Could you please reach out and get them to come on the podcast? And then you say no.
I do.
And then I have to beg.
I pitch a fit. Yeah.
And and eventually I get you on board.
Excuse me. Bribery helps. Yeah.
And we get this person on. And that's what happened today.
It is. Yeah. Lots of much wooing. Such wow. So that's about as good of an intro as we could hope for Mike Underwood. How are you, Mike?
Hello. It's great to be back. I feel like it's been forever. The pandemic makes life feel as if it has been very long and very short. So I could not say how long it's been, but it's great to be back.
I think I was actually thinking about this morning as I was putting together show notes. And I think the last time that I clearly remember being in the same place in the space-time continuum as you was that we were in Pittsburgh for the Nebula Awards eating at a Cajun restaurant. And I could not tell you to save my life who else was there.
Oh, is that the one where we had to walk like 20 minutes and go really downhill?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Yeah.
And no one is allowed to tell my husbies this, but I also cannot remember if that was the year that, because 2 years in a row, Nebulas were in Pittsburgh. And 1 year he came with me and 1 year he did not. And I cannot remember if my husband was there or not. So
convention space kind of becomes its own location, right?
Yeah.
The time space of at a convention. And even if you know the area, just so many of the experiences are so different. And so I'm just going to keep on generating alibis for you as
no,
necessary.
I dig this. This is one of the many reasons why we get on swimmingly. So I appreciate the pile of alibis.
See, a very, very long time ago. I can't even remember. This has to be over a decade, Mike. We were both at a convention. I think you were working for Orbit at the time. Or no, was it Angry Robot?
It would have been Angry Robot, yeah.
Angry Robot. He's working for Angry Robot. Mm-hmm, and I walk up to say hello, and Mike needed a bio break. And so I took over the Angry Robot booth for like 7.5 minutes while he ran.
And was that and 7.5 minutes where everyone came?
and people were coming up, and I'm just like, you know, bullshitting with them, trying to keep them around long enough for him to come back and sell them something.
Awesome. It's like a bookmark. We have these lovely titles.
Yeah.
It is definitely one of the rules of vending at a convention that the time when you either need to be eating or are away on to do business or using the restroom those are the times when the largest number of people come by. And I've known this for a very long time because I used to be the person who would be a stand-in at my friendly local game store when I was in high school and college. And so I got to experience this on the, I'm not even supposed to be here. Don't tell the managers that I'm here.
I'm technically an employee. It's like anti-manifestation or like counterfactual manifestation. Like you're sitting there and you're like, I'm going to make somebody come and I'm going to make a sale and be like, oh no shit, I have to go and do this thing. And then you walk away and maybe the world of manifestation just has like an attention deficit issue where it just clocked a moment too late. Like, oh wait, you wanted I'm sending somebody right now. It's going to be great. Wait, you're not there.
Is the universe's manifestation department running on Internet Explorer?
Oh, that is a fair concern.
That's messed up. You know, it's funny that you mention conventions and eating and stuff, because I was recently at Genghis Khan, which is a local gaming convention here in Colorado. And one of the weirdest things I'd ever seen is that whatever deal they have with the hotel does not allow vendors to have food.
Like even like here's a mint or something?
No one can have food because the hotel is charging for food. And so And what's funny is Mile High Con was at the same hotel and did not have this restriction. But the gaming convention has this restriction where it's like the vendors will like they'll go out and get food and then they have to take it to their room or take it somewhere and eat it. They can't sit there and eat it.
Huh.
And it's very weird. It's very weird. Like I hadn't seen that before. It's almost like it's McCormick Place, you know, in Chicago. It's like, no, this is all union. You can't do that shit. Except that Mile High Con can. So there's something weird in the contract as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, right. That means that either there's some like relative level of relationship package that one con has that the other one doesn't.
Because
if it was actually union regulations, we wouldn't have that variance unless there was truly something weird going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's weird that you'll be walking through there and there will be several tables that have been covered because the people are gone to go eat or gone to go do something else. Yeah, it's kind of weird.
Huh. The shroud of death lies over this table, but only for now. Come back in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Once we've had the pad thai.
We will be back.
I'm imagining like a really lovingly hand calligraphy drawn message that says the shroud of death has been spread over this table back in 5 minutes.
That would be kind of fantastic. I feel like we need to make that a thing at cons. Except the problem is I would have to run a table at a con and I really don't feel like doing that. So someone else needs to make that a thing. That's really what I'm building to.
Having had a lot of experience running tables at cons, I understand the reticence. I would do it again if necessary, but after a number of years doing that for Angry Robot, I would much prefer not to.
Yeah.
If called, I will not serve.
I've thought about it, and if there was a reason to do it, I would do it. But my first experience was terrible, and it was my own damn fault. A friend of mine and I was telling him this is back when I was in Fresno in the 90s. I was talking to him about how I go to these cons and people have these tables set up and they're selling all kinds of stuff. And he collected cards at the time and I was collecting comic books. And so we're like, well, let's just get a booth together and we'll just sell our stuff. That was a huge mistake. It was a huge mistake. I didn't realize the culture involved, which number one was anyone else selling cards was walking around looking at all the pricing and then changing all their pricing to undersell everybody else. And then the same thing was happening with comic books. So any comic books that I had for sale, people were underselling me at other tables. And it was just like this cutthroat thing that I was too young and naive and I didn't understand any of it. And so that was like a really bad first experience trying to do something at a con.
Long ago, yeah. I was at Confusion. Confusion, which is in Novi, Michigan, kind of outside of Detroit, which I think I may have seen you at various times before, Mike. It's one of the good ones for the Midwest. They have an autographing event, and that autographing event, the particular year that I did it, and maybe this is standard for them, the tables were all like this big U, right? Mm-hmm. And the bottom part of the U, if you kind of visualize, you come into the room, you come into the open part of the U, the bottom part of the U on the far side is where the guests of honor would be. And this particular year that I had a station for autographing, the guests of honor were, I think, Ada Palmer and it was definitely Jim Butcher, but I believe it was also Ada Palmer. And so, you know, there's a lot of people queuing for Jim Butcher, like an awful lot, some for Ada Palmer as well, but like absolute just, so they open the doors, there people come in and there's gotta be like 60 people deep, just lined up for the people on one side of the U can't see all the tables on the other side of the U for all the folks going down in the middle. And I happened to be on the end of the U that was slightly closer to the Jim Butcher bit of things. And so then I realized that I am doomed, that no one is going to come and look at these books or, you know, buy something from me off of Square or whatever. And I'm like, well, shit. And this may have been a powerful breach of con etiquette. What did I know at the time? But I just climbed over the top of my table and grabbed a bunch of bookmarks that happened to have like postcard size things that had like a bunch of text about books on them. And I started walking down the line and be like, here's something to read while you're waiting for Jim Butcher. Here's something to read while you're waiting for Jim Butcher. And went down and down and down and down. And like everybody in the line got one. And that was honestly the best sales that I had ever had at a con, because as people peeled off from the Jim Butcher line, having done their signings with him, they had to walk past me. And I sold like 30 books in an hour long period. It was amazing. I actually sold out. And then I was kind of like, I hope something like that happens again. It didn't. Nothing like that ever happened again. I tried to recreate the magic once with Peter Beagle being at a neighboring table to me at the Nebulas, but it didn't quite play the same way.
Yeah. Well, because for that time, the books you had to sell would have been a pretty solid, like, comparative title. Mm-hmm. If people are reading a bunch of Jim Butcher, there's a good chance that they're going to like those books that you were selling at the time. And sure. I think that probably putting my sales hat on of having been an Angry Robot and all that kind of stuff. I think there's so much more alignment there that makes it easier, especially because I find that urban fantasy, at least historically, I haven't been as like elbow deep in sales analysis for a number of years now, but I feel like at that time, urban fantasy was very much its own reading category. Mm-hmm. And so you've got behaviors that are very much within one subgenre. The folks that are omnivorous in their genres are like, I don't know if they're less likely to be the Jim Butcher super fans, but I think your ability to kind of capture another urban fantasy reader are going to be really high at that point. So well done.
Yeah.
If other people were unhappy about it, then
they should have climbed over their table faster. Right?
If they've sworn a blood vendetta and haven't caught up to you by this point, they're probably
that was 2019. So I think what really helped me was at that point, COVID. It probably saved me. Like they just lost track of me. The plagues. So, oh Lord, we've come full circle here. So I think probably it's in the theme of coming full circle, worth coming back to. There were like 15 reasons you had for like, I want to talk to Mike Underwood. But not least of them is the fact that you have been for like 2.5-3 years now doing a lot of tabletop RPG work as a GM and as a player, and it's been very much a part of your life again, Patrick, and it has very much been a part of your life, Mike. So okay, I'm shipping it right now and kiss, make it happen.
So in the email that I sent to you, Mike, I did talk about I do a lot of Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons, and here's the thing, I want to, as I'm like pulling hairs, dog hairs off my microphone thing, because
this is how people know this is authentic.
Oh my God. let me tell you what they don't tell you about a border collie. Okay. Mm-hmm. They don't tell you this about these long haired border collies. They shed like no one's business. Yeah, I mean, he's just I can't keep up with the hair anymore. Anyway, one of the things that I talk about, and I want to preface this by saying, Mike, because you're in this industry, you do not have to comment on this or anything that I say where I talk about shitty things that people do. However, I don't like Hasbro anymore. I don't like them as a company, so I don't support them as a company because that's the only thing that I can do. Right. There's nothing else I can do. I have no power over Hasbro whatsoever. So I don't buy D&D products anymore. I love Magic the Gathering. I don't buy Magic the Gathering products anymore. I love G.I. Joe. I don't buy G.I. Joe. I love Transformers. I don't buy Transformers stuff. That's the only thing that I can do as someone who's like, I don't like the way you do business. The other thing that I could do was I at the time I was deep in a 5e campaign that my friend was running. And, all the shit hit the fan and with the OGL and, Paizo came out with Remastered. And so what I did was I went out and I bought a bunch of Pathfinder Remastered stuff. And I just started learning that game. That was my entry back into Pathfinder. Originally I had played Pathfinder, with JT Evans. He introduced me to it, first edition, like in 2011, 2012, somewhere in there. And I started playing Pathfinder with him. But this was my, like, I jumped back in hard. Like I just decided if I have dollars to spend, I'm giving them to Paizo, you know, on gaming stuff. And so I've just been doing a bunch of Paizo stuff ever since, and a bunch of Pathfinder second edition remaster. And I converted my friends from 5e to Pathfinder 2e and started running a game for them. And then I just found out literally 2 days ago, 3 days ago, that when I ran them through the beginner's box and then I ran them through the very first adventure path that I did, which was Troubles in Atari, which continues the Pathfinder backs, they can now all get, and I can get, Pathfinder Society credits for me running them through that, which I did not know.
Oh, really?
Yes, because those are sanctioned to be part of Pathfinder Society. So anyway, so all this comes down to, and then, you know, when I saw Daggerheart, I thought Daggerheart looked really, really cool. And so I backed Daggerheart. A couple of my friends backed Daggerheart. We all got Daggerheart and started messing around with it. And that's, you know, kind of why I wanted to talk to you, because I know that you're in this world now. I don't know if you've always been in this world or if this is something recent for you.
So I have played tabletop role-playing games pretty consistently since I was about 9. There was a chunk of time from late 2012 through about 2015 when I was not playing them very much, because we moved from Indiana to New York and then from New York to Baltimore. And I just didn't rebuild my TTRPG playing habits for a few years. And in the interim, kind of the PBTA movement happened. And then I came back to TTRPGs and I was reading and watching all these videos, people talking about kind of different approaches to the game. And that really helped me get back into RPGs. So I've been really into RPGs for 30 years.
Well, if it makes you feel any worse, I've got a few years on you. So yeah. I started in the 80s. Yeah. So I had the blue box and the red box and the black box and the silver box. And there was like a turquoise box, I think, at one point for D&D.
Do they Voltron together?
No.
Well, but now I want them to. I want them to real, real bad.
I still have the books. Yeah. I still have the books. I still have the books. I just don't have the boxes because the boxes fell apart. Oh,
okay. Sure.
Yeah. Over the decades. But I still have all the books. And it was basically Dungeons & Dragons, and then Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, I think, was the next one. And then they just kind of kept going up from there. If I remember correctly. But I also had, like, I had the Robotech RPG. I had the Star Trek RPG, which was god awful and terrible, which I've talked about before. So I moved as well, to your point. Like, I started moving around and taking different jobs. And I did not have that community anymore until I settled again in Colorado, and then I started working with authors here. And then those authors are like, "Hey, I'm playing a game. Do you want to come play?" And I'm like, "I remember this game. Yes. Shiny Math Rocks. Let's go."
Many such cases.
And I think part of what I was emailing you about was, like, I've noticed that in teaching a lot of these games, it always comes down to the combat first and the role play second. And I feel like that's an artifact of D&D to this day. Like, it doesn't matter what game you're playing. They always jump you into combat to kind of teach you the mechanics of the game. Has that been your experience, or?
I think it's extremely common. And if we're looking in terms of industry history, right, there's kind of chainmail to D&D and a lot of games that mostly respond to or are building on D&D. And then there are some other threads of design where, right, chainmail and D&D are the beginning, but we get different traditions, different play styles, aesthetics of play. If we're thinking more expansively, we can go into LARP, and you can have Nordic LARP. And then there's however many different cultures of play that you want to talk about. But to kind of get back to the specifics, I think that for a lot of games and for a lot of people, where designers try to innovate or solve problems, quote unquote, is in how the flow of combat works or how things are mechanized, what is and isn't elided or abstracted versus what is detailed and where there is like individual expression in terms of, oh, well, my character is cool and different because I get to do these things in combat. And that's an area where I think Pathfinder has been really strong, right? I played some first edition Pathfinder. I played an Inquisitor, which was a fun, weird, janky class that had a lot of ways that you can kind of express your own ideas and show who this character is through action. And it's a thing that I really like as a storyteller, having done a lot of my fiction that is kind of action oriented, even if it's not necessarily as combat focused. And so I think that because of history, and I think there's a decent chunk of people who play TTRPGs for whom the thing that they mostly want is kind of a beer and pretzels hack and slash adventure experience. And so the games that they're considering for that, they're mostly going to be considering in terms of how well does it deliver that central aesthetic that we're looking to pursue and kind of be satisfied by, while, of course, TTRPGs can do any number of other things. And so how much a system does or doesn't focus on combat is, for me, the intersection of a bunch of these different factors, like historical, cultural, so on.
Sure. And what are you doing these days in TTRPGs? Like what are you writing? What are you working on? Like what where are you living?
Yeah, so for the past probably going on 2 years, I have mostly been focused on the Daggerheart system, right? I was an additional designer working on the game. I worked on a couple of the adventures that have come out. And then since the game's release and the community gaming license came out, I had a way to create Daggerheart compatible material and publish it. And then based on the fact that I had this experience with the game and doing streams, talking about Daggerheart and sharing my own like personal perspective on running the game, designing for the game, I was very fortunate in finding a lot of people were interested in what I had to say and the ideas that I had in terms of creating new material there. So making stuff for Daggerheart unofficially has been the big thing for me since like May or so of last year when the game was released. And most recently, the big thing that I did was publish a book of adversaries that are compatible with the Daggerheart rules, which is called Menagerie of Mayhem. And it has adversaries across all four tiers. There's a few new adversary groups, and they are manifestation of me kind of exploring some different ideas and different directions that the Daggerheart system can go in terms of using those tools and the mechanical structures that the game has to support people in storytelling that is largely informed by, if not entirely dominated by, combat, right? Daggerheart is a game that has a focus on combat, I would say, but also has a core resolution system that is pretty flexible and can be used in or out of combat. And then alongside all of that, and even before I started doing freelancing for Darrington Press, I had been working on a Forged in the Dark role-playing game. So that's a game using a system derived from Blades in the Dark by John Harper for my Genrenauts series of novellas, which I published in like mostly the mid-2010s. And taking the interdimensional story heist approach and marrying it with the very heist-oriented Forge in the Dark design system. So that I've been working on kind of on and off, and I have some publishing plans for it coming. Haven't done those big announcements, but that's kind of the other thing that I'm doing. So it's been a lot of Daggerheart compatible stuff and streaming along those lines, but I'm also bringing in some of this other stuff.
Very cool. Tracy, do you know Blades in the Dark?
I do not, actually. Yeah.
Mike, do you want to explain Blades in the Dark? So he gets up. He's like, yeah, let's go.
Are you familiar with... So there's two key touchstones for Blades in the Dark for me. Mm-hmm. One is the Dishonored series of video games by Arcane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other one is the TV show Peaky Blinders.
Okay, so Dishonored I know. Peaky Blinders I know by reputation.
Right, and so Forged in the Dark, or Blades in the Dark, is a game of scoundrels and criminals in a haunted industrial city in kind of a Victorian age-esque period. But this is a deep post-post-apocalypse, where 800-ish years ago, the sun was destroyed. And so it's a world that lives in eternal twilight or darkness. And there's all this really cool, intense world building going on. And what that mostly does is it means that you can't really leave the city. And so if you're criminals and you can't just leave town, you have to manage your heat and how much attention you're getting from other rival factions and from the police, which then means that you have all of these feedback loops of your gang tries to do something and that impinges on someone's territory. And then they strike back at you and this draws attention from the police and you try to buy them off, but then you don't have as much money to build up your crew. And it's got all these really cool interconnecting systems for a fantasy crime, like dark fantasy crime heist series.
Take my money. Yeah.
See, I didn't want to say anything, but I did feel like Blades in the Dark would be a Tracy jam. I do feel like that.
All right. So, so I guess this is not a question that's grounded in any particular system or any particular necessarily like writing experience or game design experience you've created for yourself or had the opportunity to be part of. But for me, it's always an interesting question because I have had the chance to run tabletop games before as the storyteller or GM, and I've played in many of them as well. But it always strikes me as interesting how people answer this question. So I'll pose it to you, Mike. Do you think you want the same things when you're playing a game that you want when you're running a game?
I would say, so the simple answer that's not as useful is sometimes, but yeah. To expand on it a bit, right now, because I spend a lot of time designing for stuff that uses the Daggerheart rules, right, with this third party license, when I'm playing, I have been trying to seek out games that use different design families, different design philosophies, because I've found that as a designer, I was much better. And as a GM and player, the more I played a bunch of different games and came to analyze and understand, what is this game trying to do? How is it trying to do it? How well does it do it? Where do I think it maybe misses the mark, or what is it doing in a really interesting way? Can I port that over to other things, right? Being really omnivorous in my playing has been great for me as a designer and writer in a way that I think is pretty parallel to being omnivorous as a reader and how that informs my writing, right? I read a lot of, and I still read a fair amount of, especially contemporary romance, starting in about a decade ago. And there is so much incredible interiority and character writing that's done in romance. Mm-hmm. And that informed my writing moving forward, so that the book that I published in 2020, which was a space opera, I think has some of the best character work and interpersonal writing that I've done because I was drawing on the excellence and craft from these other writers. And so I've tried to learn that lesson as well and put that into practice in TTRPGs, where having a broader vocabulary means that I'm able to be a lot more precise. And it then means that I get to do the fun thing of like, oh, well, I'm talking to a fellow designer and I say, are you familiar with this obscure indie RPG from 2006? I think it's doing something really interesting that might be informative or inspirational for you based on what I see here and what you're trying to do. A la someone being like, I'm really looking for extremely specific book recommendation, and then realizing that you have the perfect thing for them.
It's like gaming sommelier.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny that you bring this up, Tracy. I got to play the Dresden Files role-playing game at one point, which I believe, is that Fate?
Yeah, I think it's Fate right before they publish Fate Core, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, so it's Fate, but it's slightly different. Mm-hmm. But one of the mechanics that I liked as a player at that time was that in your character creation, there was a point where you had to work with the other people at the table to decide how you knew each other and come up with like a thing from your past where you interacted with them. And it made the table feel closer, right? It was the opposite of the D&D trope where it's like, okay, so
I'll walk into the tavern.
You're in the tavern, you're sitting at a table and someone starts a fight. Like, and then you have to fight. Mm-hmm. It was completely, so I really like that. What's really funny is, so I go to Genghis Khan for the first time last year, mm-hmm. and I play Pathfinder Society for the first time ever. At this time, I am running my friends who were 5e players through the Pathfinder Beginner's Box, and it's taking forever. And I feel like it's all my fault. And really, it's a rules thing. Like, they're just kind of struggling with rules and things are just different and they're just not understanding. And again, I feel like that's my fault. But I sit down at Pathfinder Society and I see them doing so many different things in one scenario, because Pathfinder has all these different subset rules that you can do. Like, oh, you have political things. So you have an influence system that you now have to run for the political thing. Oh, you're going to infiltrate. Well, there's an infiltration set of rules. And when Mike's talking about like Blades in the Dark as an example, yeah. It's like they're taking one of those subsets of rules and they're building a whole game around it and making it so fucking cool, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you look at Daggerheart, I mean, I've got the rule book kind of pulled up here. I do like that they have the touchstones section mm-hmm. in the core rule book. And I don't know if you've seen this, Tracy, but it's Daggerheart derives inspiration from a variety of sources. Below is an abridged list of media the design team drew from while crafting this game. And then they just list a ton of shit and a ton of games, including Pathfinder and D&D and different ones. And so, you know, I like it when they're pulling the things that they like. And this can be any game system. They're like, oh, I really liked the fate thing where everybody knows each other at the table. You have to come up with something like that.
Yeah.
And let's put that in there. I will say that in Giles's new game that I'm playing, which is Pathfinder, when he did that, it pissed me off because I didn't want my character to know anybody. So that's the thing where you're talking about, you know, as a player, as a DM or GM.
Do you want the same? Yeah.
Do you want the same thing? Most of the time, yes. I was really happy in the Dresden Files game. But then when it came time to roll a new character, I was like, oh, I'm going to be the mysterious guy that no one has ever seen before. Okay. How do you know someone else at the table? God damn it, Giles.
I wanted to make that your problem.
Yeah. It's like, well, just tell me where he's from. No, I don't want to.
For me, that comes down to kind of a session zero table agreements thing, right? Like, what type of fun are we hoping to have? What kind of story do we want to tell? And so, right, if that was something that you and Giles and the other players had already discussed, then you can kind of refer back to that existing conversation. But right, sometimes you do want to have a character fit certain sets of archetypes or have a certain type of role coming in. Right? A new person coming into an existing group is automatically going to change a lot of dynamics. And if a PC died and then another PC shows up, right? The presence of absence of an old character is going to be really important. So there is absolutely stuff to dig into there, but it's generally been my experience since getting to see systems like how characters were connected in the Dresden Files RPG through more recent games, where a lot of the games that I play now and basically any game I design at this point, I'm going to want to have those connection questions or ways of building those connections. But that's also a bit of work as the designer saying, here are some baselines that I think you're going to want to use to tell the kinds of stories that this game is set up to be able to tell. And I think a challenge with a game like Pathfinder or D&D or potentially Daggerheart and other games is if a game reaches a certain level of popularity, people are going to try and do a zillion different things with it.
Oh yeah.
And for me, each game is designed with certain intentionality and certain objectives, and that the closer you align what you're trying to do with a game with what the game was designed to be able to do, the less friction you're going to have there. But some people like friction, and so it can be really tricky.
Some people also like really crunchy,
absolutely,
number stuff. I have a friend who he loves like min-maxing his characters and mm-hmm. getting to the point where it's like if he hits, he's doing 65 points of damage. Like he's just figured out how to do that. And that's his fun part. And role play, as an example, is his least fun part. Mm-hmm. And the thing that he doesn't really get into. Tracy most famously has announced on this podcast in the past that she played the Zelazny.
The Amber RPG. Diceless.
But I can't remember, like, was that very role play heavy or was there a mix of role play and combat? Was it skill checks? Like, how did that work?
Because it's diceless, there's no such thing as a skill check. Okay. Like there's not tables for things. It does not work that way. And that for some people is an immediate nope out. This kind of goes back to what Mike is talking about with the idea of like, what is a game well suited to do and well positioned to do, and kind of session zero adjacent, what are tables of players suited to or interested in, right? And so if you're motivated by like, oh yeah, I love like the Chronicles of Amber as a core world story basis, but I panic at the idea of there are not tables and dice and sort of metrics of various kinds that allow me to do my 65 points of damage, min max, etc., then however much you love that core storytelling world, you might be better served taking things that, you know, kind of borrow from Zelazny's oeuvre and putting them into a different container, right? For the Amber Diceless role-playing game, the closest things that there are to mechanics are two things. Everybody has four different ability scores, and there's a bidding war at the start of the game between all of the different players to be ranked first or second or third or whatever. In the meantime, all the NPCs, which are obviously controlled by the GM, also have their own scores in these areas. And so you might know that you're first in warfare relative to, say, three other players, but you don't necessarily know where you rank in warfare relative to the other NPCs that you're going to encounter, right? So you know only to a certain extent, like, how much of a badass am I in this sphere? The other thing, and yes, there's like, you basically get it's a point buy system, by which I literally mean the points buy things, not like this many points to get this many ranks or whatever. You know, there's different powers. You have, say, generally the default is a 100-point character, unless you're doing something different. And certain powers that you can put into your character are more expensive. If you buy those powers, then that's less that you have for the auction. Typically, you do the auction first. And so you have to decide, are you going to go in knowing I'm going to reserve this much of my point total to buy certain powers or not? The other thing, which is the mechanic, is a system called stuff. It's literally just called stuff. And how much stuff you have, there's three types of stuff. There's zero stuff, meaning you spent all the points for your character down to the wire. All 100 points were spent. If you spent more points than you actually had, then you're a bad stuff character. You can actually spend into the negatives. And generally, there's a limit. Like, you're not supposed to go too far. Like, anything above 3 or 4 points of bad stuff is considered quite a lot of stuff. And these are the things that tilt the GM's judgment about in outcomes where, you know, it kind of could reasonably go either way. It's almost always going to go badly for you. That's the trade-off. So you get a little more power than everyone else, but the universe kind of hates you and keeps crapping on you. If you underspend deliberately to reserve some points, you are a good stuff character, which means, as you would guess, the opposite. It also has to do with social things. If you meet someone and they have no reason to know anything about you or judge you one way or the other, if you're a bad stuff character, you give off vibes. And these vibes are not great. Like, dogs are probably going to growl at you and you'll seem a little sinister and maybe that's cool and whatever, but a little untrustworthy. You can play that character however you want, but your stuff is going to determine things. If you're a good stuff character, on the other hand, people give you the benefit of the doubt and, you know, things tend to work out and you seem trustworthy, even if maybe you aren't, and so on. And so you have these tools to develop your character with, but there is not, once that character is developed, some kind of mechanism by which the DM can then just say, in all situations, these are the types of outcomes that you'll have. Like, if you are first in warfare and you're fighting against another character, if you're higher ranked in warfare than they are, then you will win. Unless they figure out some way of like twisting the combat around so that maybe they can hold you off just long enough that because they're higher in endurance, you wear out. Or if they disarm you or come inside your guard well enough so that they can grapple you, if they're higher in strength, maybe they're going to break your arm. And that makes things different. Or maybe it's really tight all around and it's going to come down to stuff. Or it's going to come down to like, how well can I kind of explain the actions that I'm taking in this situation and how well do they suit. Sometimes it comes down to the GM deciding, you know what, the cooler narrative outcome is this thing. And so it is, as a system, a kind of giant trust fall into the arms of the rest of the players and the GM, which for a lot of people is just really not doable.
Sure. So, okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for explaining that, because I've been curious. I do have one last question for Mike before we switch over to Picks of the Week.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you think of the like OSR revival kind of thing that's happening right now in TTRPGs? I mean, you've got Shadow Dark is huge. You've got, what's it like, Dungeon Crawl Classics or something is yep. up and coming. You've got those kinds of old school games coming back.
So the kind of old school aesthetic is not one that I am especially drawn to. I have played D&D in some styles that fit that, but that was when I was like really young. So yeah. I don't know that I necessarily was doing it the same way that people who were 15 in 1985 were doing.
Hush.
The things I tend to go to tabletop role-playing games for don't necessarily align super well with how, to my knowledge, OSR games are designed. The OSR is a design tradition I'm not especially well versed in. I have a couple of the games. I've mostly engaged with OSR material, like adventure material, where I think they're doing some really cool things in terms of world building and fiction and storytelling through like tables and like generative systems for emergent play. The style of role playing that I kind of default to and return to most frequently relies a bit less on that like skill of the player, emergent storytelling, like reactive in a bit of a different way, right? I don't want to overstate OSR stuff because, again, I don't know it especially well. The thing that I have found, though, is looking at OSR adventure material, there's really cool approaches that those designers are taking and some really impressive levels of being concise and evocative in presenting material. There is a couple of books in a setting known as the Electrum Archive by Emil Bovin, who most recently was publishing a game called DERF. And it's this very cool science fantasy setting. And each of these books is, you know, it's like five by eight digest size. Yeah. And only 100-ish pages, but there's so much stuff in there. And so I think there's work being done in the OSR space that I find really, really impressive. And I love how healthy and vigorous a discourse they have in terms of debating design ideas and things like that. It's just that the things they're designing toward overlap only a little bit with the types of fun I'm looking to have. But I absolutely went to some OSR materials and have been thinking about OSR approaches to sandbox design in how I have been drawing influence for the Dungeons of Drakenheim book that I'm working on. So I very much view it as these are colleagues who are doing something kind of adjacent and somewhat overlapping with what I'm doing. And I have respect for what they're doing. It's just not as much my thing.
Sure. No, I get it. Okay, Tracy, are you ready?
I am ready.
We'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, They say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes, like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month, and that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month, and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever, our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week. Angry Robot. Tracy, since you haven't been saying much in this episode because you've been letting me talk so much, why don't you go first and tell us what your pick of the week is?
Sure. Lately, I've been picking some games, which is not atypical for me. But this particular game hasn't hit the table in a little while in Shea Townsend, but did last night because we were looking for something kind of fun and kind of quick and that we could do together. And granted, playing it with three people is not as good as playing it with a larger number, but still a good time overall. We played Skull. So Skull is a game produced by Space Cowboys. It's a small box game that has really fun and interesting components that are these die-cut card sort of cardboard things here. This is going to be meaningless because we are, of course, a audio-only podcast, but I'm going to use the video to show y'all anyway. You get these sets of round discs, and they all have each set has a theme. This one happens to be sort of Japanese in style, and there's a skull, and then there's three flowers. In this case, we got some chrysanthemums. And so you've got these several different decks, as it were, and each one has these four different tokens, and one of them's a skull, three of them are flowers. The idea is you are trying in this bidding and bluffing game to get other people killed. And the way you get them killed is by forcing them to turn over the tokens they've placed in front of themselves until they reveal their own skull, or turning over your tokens until they reveal one of your skulls. How does this happen? You go around and you decide from your four things, only one of which is a skull, which one to put down in secret face down. Everybody goes around and does that until somebody decides it's time to stop laying down these tokens and instead make a bet. And the bet is, how many can I turn over before I hit a skull? So you might say one, and then the next person needs to decide, are they going to go two, or are they going to say, I'm out, and I'm not going to play this game, and so on and so on. You always start by turning over your own token. So obviously, if you were to say one and the person next to you is like, no, I'm out, they just basically told on themselves that they have a skull laid out there. And so this is a sort of social deduction game. It's a screw your neighbor game. It's a bidding game. It's a bluffing game. It plays 3 to 6 players with very easy rules, really cool and handsome looking components. And the whole thing, even with a truly skillful, cutthroat and decisive group of the full 6, can take maybe a half an hour at the absolute most. And so Skull is very worth it if you've got people who are interested in a kind of beer and pretzels sort of fun gaming experience. I recommend you check it out.
That's awesome. Mike, how about you? Pick.
So I want to build on a discussion of Daggerheart by shouting out a book by a colleague. My friend and colleague Carlos Cisco, who is also a designer on Daggerheart, has been creating Daggerheart compatible stuff, and he released the first volume of Pistol Heart, which is a series of supplements supporting kind of Weird West or Western fantasy RPG play using the Daggerheart rules. Nice. Carlos and I both worked on a weird Western campaign frame in the core rulebook called Colossus of the Drylands, which is basically Red Dead Redemption meets Shadow of the Colossus, if I can pitch it in a really concise fashion. And what Carlos is doing here is supporting not just that frame, but conveniently that frame with more Western fantasy stuff. So it's like Western themed subclasses and some adversaries. And he's been doing like a modular release approach. So volume one had X many subclasses and some other things. And then volume two is going to have more subclasses and more adversaries. And I've had the chance of talking with Carlos about some of the things that are coming in volume two and beyond. And let me tell you, folks, Carlos is cooking some really cool things using the Daggerheart system. And so if you are already into Daggerheart and you're looking for more resources by people who you can be trusted to deliver quality material, I definitely want you to check out Pistol Heart.
Fantastic.
Very cool. And I don't understand, because I just haven't looked at it. Is there a Daggerheart marketplace, or is this all on DriveThruRPG, or is this somewhere else where that would be sold and your own stuff would be sold?
Yeah, so a lot of people publishing Daggerheart compatible stuff are on DriveThruRPG. A lot are also on itch.io, which is mostly known for like really indie RPGs and some video games. But there is also a Daggerheart specific marketplace called heartofdaggers.com. And it is a platform for sharing a lot of homebrew, but also a platform people can publish onto. And the entire platform is no generative AI.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Nice.
Yeah, that's been a problem at DriveThruRPG.
Yeah, for sure.
It's been a real problem. Well, thank you. That is also very cool. My pick is very quick this week. I will say that I have not been feeling well this week. I think I was food poisoned. Tracy thinks I had the flu. Either way, the results were gross. And so I didn't have a lot of time to think about picks, but I did watch the very first episode of Young Sherlock on Amazon Prime. And this is a series from Guy Ritchie. And if you remember, Guy Ritchie did the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies, a couple of those where he was like an action hero as well as, you know, being super smart. And I think this is a prequel to that. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, it's very Guy Ritchie. Mm-hmm. Like there's plenty of deductions going on. There's plenty of, you know, the Sherlock Holmes kind of things that you're expecting. However, in the very first episode, he meets Moriarty and they kind of become friends as young men and at Oxford. But I liked it. And so I'm willing to give it a couple more episodes. So that's my pick this week, which is, again, Young Sherlock. It's over on Amazon Prime. Okay, Tracy.
Yeah, this has been
your stuff.
Yeah, super cool episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. Mike, where can people find you and the super cool stuff that you're making, particularly your freshest, newest, fanciest super cool stuff?
Yeah, so I'm on Blue Sky at mikerunderwood.bsky.social. my Patreon, where I publish a lot of my thoughts about and material for use with the DaggerHeart system at patreon.com/MichaelR. Underwood. And you can find references and links from there to Menagerie of Mayhem, the adversary book that I built, as well as a bunch of other stuff. And paid subscribers will get access to a lot of that before anything else. So if you're looking to get everything that I'm doing with regards to TTRPGs, DaggerHeart specifically, and or my own stuff, you want to go to Patreon. And then I do videos and streams that show up at youtube.com/@MikeUnderwood.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for being with us, Mike.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. It's fun to get to hear about what other people are doing with RPGs and to talk shop a bit, you know, shop and history and other things. And yeah, I could go on for hours and hours about like, aesthetics of play and stuff. So it's fun to get to uncork that bottle a bit with y'all.
One of the things that DaggerHeart gives you is, and it may have just been with the Kickstarter. I don't know if they do this now, but when you buy the core set of stuff, they give you digital assets for like the cards. Because Tracy, every class comes with its own cards. This is like an answer to D&D. Because D&D, a lot of times, you could go out and buy the spell cards and stuff for your classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ooh. Mike's showing his pictures. So what's funny is, so Giles gets that. And you get the physical cards in your set, but then they give you the digital cards. And he has been printing out the digital cards. He's like, I don't want other people's grubby fingerprints on my cards.
Less. Sleeve them, bro. Just sleeve them.
So I thought that was kind of cool. Anyway, thank you. Thank you again, Mike. We appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great to hang out and chat.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. @the-functional-nerds on Facebook. @functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And @thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY.social. I know, I couldn't keep a copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent, so you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening, and I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.